This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with the HBD blogger, Sebastian Jensen. Sebastian, great speaking with you.
Hello. Thank you.
To start things off, can you give us a brief introduction about yourself, how you got interested in HBD, and is your moniker in honor of Arthur Jensen?
So I've been terminally online ever since I was 12. And I started using 4chan around the time I turned 14 or 15. And people would discuss stuff like nature and nurture, or the causes of racial differences in criminality and intelligence. And I would listen in. I thought the idea that, for example, racial groups differed in their genetic predisposition to intelligence possible. But the thing is that when I was 16, my statistical skills weren't as strong as they are now, so I didn't feel very confident in my own belief. But by the time I turned 20 or 21 and I got more worldly, I got better at statistics, and I tried harder to research the kind of causes of racial differences in traits we care about, like intelligence, social status, and whatnot. And I found that it was basically undeniable that there was some genetic influence responsible for these differences. And so, not too long after that I started blogging, and I chose the moniker Sebastian Jensen, partially because I thought it sounded cool, and partially because of the psychologist Arthur Jensen.
And what's your background? I think you said that you're half Mexican, but you were raised Mormon.
Yes. So my father is from Mexico. My mother is from Maine. She's white. Both of my parents were born into the Mormon Church. I eventually left when I was 15. But otherwise, yeah, I was raised Mormon.
Do you think that HBD will ever be normalized?
It's a rough question. So I find it hard to believe that the same level of censorship and denial of evidence can perpetuate for forever. I don't think that's possible. Question is when those social restrictions will be relaxed. I think that a lot of people right now are very optimistic because we're getting new genetic evidence using GWAS. And so what GWAS is that it's a technique that it basically looks at not every single gene, but it looks at genes that vary frequently among individuals, and then it correlates those genes with certain phenotypes like intelligence or education. And the GWAS for education is pretty good right now. Just with genes, we can predict about 16% of the variance in educational attainment, which is less than what we think we can do, but we're not really sure yet. And we find reasonably large racial differences in genetic predispositions to intelligence and education. I think this is basically the evidence we wanted all along. I assume that if you were to travel back in time and present people these results, a lot of them would agree and say that they do suggest that hereditarianism is true. Of course, that some people would stay in still be in denial. Some people just say you're lying, of course, but you can't really do anything about that. The problem is that people still don't want to give up. You still have people like Sasha Gusev or Kevin Bird who are trying their best to interpret the results in a way that is consistent with this small genetic influence on racial differences and traits we care about. And the short of it is that they're wrong. But the long answer is that basically they're making the debate very abstract and complicated because it turns out that you can analyze the data in a way that is more consistent with an environmental influence. And this is by using the sibling GWAS. And so there's another technique where you can see if you can like try to control for the environmental factors or population stratification by using siblings. And so what you do is that you see if one allele is correlated with intelligence even between two siblings, right? That's the idea. And when you use these GWASs that are based on siblings, you get smaller racial differences. But our criticism is that these sibling GWASs have a very low power, and they predict very little variation in intelligence. Because there's just not many samples of siblings who have their genes decoded, and so it's harder to explain variance, right? And so that's our criticism, that it's a power failure and not a null. Problem is that this, you know, what I'm explaining to you is, you know, very abstract, very complicated. To be honest, there's still, like, some gaps. There's some parts of that I honestly just don't understand very well. And when you make the debate very abstract and very complex, you also make it very inaccessible. And so by making the debate inaccessible, you also make it non-influential. And because of that, I don't think the new genetic evidence is actually having that much sway on academia, media, and the public, unfortunately. And so in terms of when I think HPD could be normalized, I think that it's probably going to happen in the second part of the century. And my prediction is that climate change is going to become a very focal issue. I think it's happening. I think it's caused by humans. I'm on the fence about how bad it's going to be, but I think that it's going to make it more difficult to live in places like Africa and India. More importantly, people are going to believe that it's making it hard to live in places like Africa and India. And because of that, people are going to want those people to immigrate to colder countries that are on average going to be populated by white and Asian people who have kind of developed their own countries, right? And so the fact that these Africans and Indians aren't as smart or hardworking isn't as much of a concern anymore, because the what's causing people to support immigration isn't actually some kind of egalitarianism. It's more about morality and a perception that kind of these Europeans and Asians are screwing over these sub-Saharan Africans and Indians because they're polluting the earth with fossil fuels, right? And that's my prediction, is that human biodiversity is going to be less important in people's political preferences moving forward. And I think that's going to result in it being less taboo.
What are the current trends in fertility by ethnicity? How are they changing? And which groups are stabilizing and which are declining the fastest?
If you're asking this question, that means you've probably been following me for a long time. I don't talk as much about this topic, but I used to talk about it a lot on my older account. And basically, the older alt-right was concerned about two things. They were concerned about fertility not being the same across racial groups. For example, Latinos, Arabs, Blacks typically had a very high fertility, and white city stations typically had very low fertility, and this was true across countries, and also it was also true within countries. And the second thing was that it seems that less intelligent people are, on average, having more children, and so moving forward, you would expect there to be less intelligent people as a result, and that could have consequences on culture and the economy that are not good for us, right? And so the problem here is that it seems that the fertility of racial groups is starting to converge a lot faster than
we
expected.
I saw a chart somewhere that showed actually white fertility now is kind of like plateaued. It's not declining as much as it was a decade or a few decades ago.
I think white and black fertility is like basically the same right now in the United States.
Oh yeah, I think so.
Hispanic fertility is still higher, but that's driven by first-generation immigrants.
I think what happened is there was a dip in Hispanic fertility after the 08 financial crisis. And it was declining throughout the 2010s, and then there was like a resurgence after the Biden migrant crisis.
So I don't believe that the drop in Hispanic fertility is caused by the economy. I think it's caused by there being more second-generation Hispanics who have fertility levels that are in line with whites. As a result, I think that moving forward, the United States will have fairly equally distributed fertility across races, except that I think that East Asians are going to be slightly below the other three racial groups. And in the second world, we seem to be observing very strong decreases in fertility. I think Chile has a TFR of like 0.9 right now, which is fucking crazy, to be honest. I would have never expected that if I was just 12 years old and looking at data on the internet, right?
I think Puerto Rico maybe too.
Yeah, Puerto Rico's really low too. And this is, I don't know. Bronze Age Pervert actually talked about this on his podcast. He thinks that the cause of low fertility among kind of the second world places like Iran or Chile, he thinks that the cause of this is people being exposed to these kind of aspirational lifestyles or sexual partners that aren't realistic for them in the class and region they're in.
These changes like social media immediately, while the first world Western nations had more time to kind of adjust to it.
Maybe that has something to do with it, I'm not sure, but I think that the fertility fall that we're seeing in the 2010s and 2020s is driven by social media. I'm kind of hesitant to put the blame on social media here because we've tried to do it for stuff like anxiety and depression. Turns out that was all bunk. And I think there's a lot of things that people try to blame social media on, but I don't think there's a lot of good empirical evidence for it. But the thing about social media is that it's exposing like a lot of these maybe middle-class Mexican, Russian, Turkish people to these 18-year-old blonde, nubile Swedish girls or these K-pop stars who cause people to maybe be a little demoralized because they realize that there's just something better out there and they can't get it because of the region and social class they're in. And it's also true for lifestyles where do you know those TikToks where people like post their lifestyle, like they post when they wake up, they post their breakfast, they post their house, and they post themselves going to work.
Like people, it's always like a penthouse, but with a super like minimalistic, sterile aesthetic.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, we're not the only ones watching that stuff, right? There's people in the third world, people in Chile, people in Brazil who are watching that stuff, and they're thinking to themselves that, oh, there's something better out there. And even though they can't get it, that doesn't like really register in their minds. Like maybe they understand it, but it doesn't really register deeper within. And as a result, they're more reluctant to settle with, I don't know, like a Russian guy who's very violent, or maybe a fat Brazilian woman, I don't know. And so I think that social media is really taking a toll on the second world's fertility.
Do you think there's any validity to the breeder selection theory that speculates that demographics that experience a fertility crash earlier are at a long-term advantage? Because assuming that those who survive are genetically selected for higher fertility, so assuming the heritability of fertility, for instance, like white fertility, mm-hmm. may outpace non-white fertility in the future, assuming the validity of this scenario. And one argument for this,
I think that's a little optimistic,
is that France's fertility crashed first, and today it's mm-hmm. a bit healthier than the rest of Europe.
Yeah, so the thing about breeder selection theory is that the heritability of fertility is pretty low. It's not as low as people say it is. There's some people who say the heritability of fertility is like 3% or 5%. It's not true. It's like 10 to 20% pretty consistently across every study. It's increasing a little bit in later years because it's easier to choose to have kids or not to have kids now. But the thing about breeder selection theory is that it assumes that the genes that cause fertility are invariant across generations, and that's not tenable. And so I assume that if you were to clone Isaac Newton, raise him in a modern environment, he probably would be even smarter than he was in the 1500s in England, because, you know, he can grow to be healthier. And the same genes that made him smart in the 1500s also make him smart in the 2000s. I don't think that's true for fertility at all. If you look at, like, the 1800s, the kinds of genes that cause people to have children are probably genes related to risk-taking, impulsivity, extroversion. And if you look across time genetically, I remember Camille posted something about this. If you look across time, the genetic correlation between homosexuality and fertility has been decreasing. Back in the day, there was a positive genetic correlation, bizarrely enough. People who were genetically homosexual, whatever you want to call that, were having more kids than people who were genetically heterosexual.
Interesting.
I'm being kind of ironic here because the implication is that...
Are you talking about people in the past who were suppressed homosexuals who married women and reproduced?
The implication is that homosexuality is not very heritable. If you look at twin studies, homosexuality has, on average, a heritability of about 30%. If you take two identical twins, and one of them is gay, on average, the other twin is gay about 25% of the time. I don't mean to be mean here, but they're just not born that way. I'm sorry. But the reason why those gay people, the quote-unquote gay people, in the past were having so many children is that they were sexually promiscuous, they were impulsive, they liked to have sex, and so because they had sex, they had children. Now that's not really the case anymore, because you can just put a condom on. Or you can, when worse comes worse, you can just get an abortion if you don't want to have a child. And people still do have unplanned pregnancies, but they don't happen as frequently as they did before. And as a result, I don't think the same genes that cause fertility, I don't think those are generationally invariant. What I do think is that I think that society is going to be pretty stable for the next 100 to 500 years. Assuming no nukes get dropped, that's the one thing that could really shake things up, is if we get nuclear war. Otherwise, I don't really have a strong reason to believe that society is going to change substantially in the next 500 years. I think we're going to get wealthier, but I don't think our culture is going to shift dramatically. As a result, I think that over time, we're going to see groups with low levels of fertility start to rise again for genetic reasons. As in people who kind of just choose to have children in the modern environment are probably going to, I think those genes are going to sustain themselves for a reasonable amount of time. And even beyond that, I think it's possible that cultures that have kind of persistently low levels of fertility, I think it's possible that there might be a cultural shift in favor of higher fertility norms, but I'm not confident in that prediction because it just hasn't been observed before, right?
We've
never
mean like
seen...
there's some chart, I forget the study, but the chart, there's a research that shows that the fertility divide between liberals and conservatives is greater now than it was in the past.
That is true. That is true. That can be empirically verified. It is true, yes.
What are your thoughts on the U-shaped trend in fertility among class lines and the genetic traits that economic class is selecting for?
So I think that with fertility and class, there's two things going on. One of them is the phenotype. One of them is the trait. I think the social class phenotype causes people to have less children because they're more concerned with working. They're not as impulsive. They don't have as many unplanned pregnancies because they make different types of decisions. But the trait itself, there's pretty good evidence based on shocks to housing prices that wealth does cause fertility. But the thing is that the relationship isn't strong enough for the cross-sectional relationship to be pushed in the opposite direction.
I think it's more like a J than a U. So with fertility, it's super high among the – it's highest among the poor. Then it dips way down among the middle class. Then it goes back up again with the wealthy.
And like millionaires,
more,
yeah.
Yeah, like it's more like a, but it's more like a J than a U.
I'm not very confident on this, but I think that part of it might be because there's different class phenotypes. And so middle class people might be like, they might be intelligent, but they also might be more risk averse and maybe not as inclined to, you know, take risks, as I stated before. But the thing about rich people is that I think that rich people might be less risk averse than middle class people. Because they're kind of willing to take these risks, and eventually one of them pays off and they get wealthy, right? And I think that phenotype causes people to have more children as well. But I think some of it is also just trait causation where wealth causes people to have more children. Though it's a weak relationship, so it's hard to observe cross-sectionally.
Do you think the classes, like, they're becoming more stratified genetically? I mean, even among, like, just say the same race, like, just again, white people, do you think middle-class white people, upper-class white people are stratifying genetically, or even, like, in things like physical appearance, too?
You know, Clark has studied this, and it seems that assortative mating for social class is pretty consistent across generations. It's just true that, like, mates like all the time. So I think that the classes have been about as genetically segregated as they always have been. Now, I have read Coming Apart by Murray, and the phenomenon he describes where there's kind of a cognitive elite that studies at these prestigious universities and kind of congregates in the same areas, the same towns, the same jobs. I think that's a real thing, but at the population level, that's not really observed because that cognitive elite is such a marginal fraction of the American population. In terms of beauty, independent of any data, it's kind of obvious that social classes and races differ in their beauty standards. Black people seem to really like large women, to be euphemistic. And white men seem to be more interested in thinner bodies than kind of larger breasts or butts. Dutton and Kierkegaard have also studied this and found that intelligent men are more likely to favor breasts or face, whereas less intelligent men seem to be really into butts and breasts. And so I think that
facial beauty is more a sign of case selection, while favoring like big butts and breasts is a sign of our selection.
I think it's possible, yeah. And I do definitely notice in my own life that there is some phenotypic differentiation where it seems that the beauty standards that the upper class likes are more likely to be found in the upper class. And the same goes for the lower class. Now, I don't think it's appropriate to say that like results in two different races being bred or whatever, because there is still a decent amount of mating that goes on between classes. It's not that uncommon for rich people to date poor people, though it's much less common than rich people dating rich people. But the thing is that there only needs to be so many people mating across class lines for the genes to be convergent. I haven't looked too deeply into the math on this, but if you have two racial groups and there's still, and only like a small amount of them outbreed, over time they converge into the same race because of those people who are outbreeding, even if they are a substantial minority.
Since you're from a Mormon background, do you consider Mormonism to be an evolutionary strategy? And
no.
Do you have thoughts on some of the fertility trends among Mormons? I think one of the – I forget the name off the top of my head, but I know those famous natalists on – who have a big YouTube channel had a talk mm-hmm. about this.
Back in the day, Mormons had huge families. I'm from a family of six.
Did you grow up in Utah?
No. Grew up in Spain. The thing about Mormon fertility is that it's crashing quite a bit.
Because I think I saw somewhere like Utah, and Utah's only like 50% Mormon. It's not the entire state. Mm-hmm. But I think for a long time it was number one in fertility.
Oh, absolutely.
I think now it's about third or fourth. I think Nebraska mm-hmm. and one of the Dakotas is ahead of it.
I'm not really sure what caused the crash in Mormon fertility. I'm not as tuned into the culture because I left the church at a pretty young age. But the thing is that Mormons were pretty culturally isolated from the rest of the United States. And what that means is that for a group to have perpetually high level of fertility, they need to be more culturally isolated than Mormons are from Americans. That's a pretty difficult thing to do. So I'm not very optimistic about there being high fertility groups that survive the coming population collapse.
So I forget the name of them. Do you know those famous natalist advocates?
They're a
married couple.
The Collinses?
Yeah, the Collins, that's right. They had a talk on this, and they said among Mormons, the groups of the highest fertility, they're the wealthiest and then these like religious offshoots, religious sects, but among sort of the mainstream middle class, there's like a huge crash in fertility.
Yeah, wealthy Mormons have lots of kids. You notice it.
Do you predict that more racial mixing in the future will actually make people more racist, considering that the process of interracial marriage and assorted mating is creating these new ethnogenesis, but then also like purebreds become like more distinct?
That was something that I believed in the past, but I don't. I guess it's not appropriate to say I don't hold that belief anymore. I just hold a more complex version of it. So if you look at whites, people who are 100% white, you generally find two different attitudes towards race. You find like colorblind wokeness, stuff like that, among some people, and then among other people, you find some sort of like identitarian, you find more of an identitarian impulse. They might not necessarily be racist or hateful, but they have like a strong sense of white identity, right? And the thing about racial mixing is that I think that's going to cause both of these attitudes to become less common, much less common for that matter. I don't think you're going to see that kind of woke colorblind stuff anymore. But I also don't think you're going to see white identitarianism as much, because those beliefs don't really make sense in a more racially mixed society. In a racially mixed society, you're probably going to see more quote-unquote Baptist kind of racial attitudes. You kind of believe in some racial supremacy, but you're still racially inclusive in your day-to-day life. And I also think that in a racially mixed society, you're more likely to see HBD-adjacent beliefs, because in my experience, mixed-race people are not as sensitive about this kind of stuff because they don't have a strong sense of racial identity. And as a result, they're more... I mean, most racially mixed people don't believe in HBD, but they're more lenient, I guess you could say, with regards to people who believe it.
What do you think of the whole, like, meme Castizo Futurism? The idea of, like, a blended of whites and Latinos and to a sort of new ethnogenesis and, like, the connotations of that?
I haven't worked out on the math on this. Spandrel actually asked me to do it. But you could mathematically predict with, I think, decent accuracy what United States will look like genetically in 100 years. My gut feeling is that whites, Hispanics, and to a lesser degree Asians are going to mix into the same race.
But not blacks as much.
No, no. Even with a lot of cultural conditioning, people are still very averse to dating black people.
Or their descendants have a more stronger black identity.
I'm not sure. I guess we'll have to see.
You're half Mexican, so
yeah.
Like I've noticed, like with from your dad's side, but I've noticed with people who are half white and half Mexican, like from their dad's side, they tend to have more like socially dominant personalities. But for, if they're Mexican from their mom's side and a white dad, like they're much more chill compared to those with Mexican dads and white moms. Have you noticed that too? Do you have thoughts
yes,
on like the personality
definitely.
Difference? And then also Steve Saylor. Another thing I heard Steve Saylor said is those with Latino dads and white moms also have higher incomes.
I haven't looked into the higher incomes thing, but my experience is that the kinds of people who get into like non-white male and white female relationships, those are like a different kind of people from people who get into like white male and non-white female relationships. I think it has to do with their perception of their family. And so I assume that white girls who are very sensitive to what their family thinks are less likely to date non-white men. And white guys who
so
are willing
bigger
to
risk,
date...
You say bigger risk takers.
Yeah, that too. And then white guys who are willing to date non-white women are probably less interested in physical appearance. As a result, they're probably nerdier guys. Social conditioning, I don't think plays as much as a role in who white men date because their family members don't really care, right? Because they're men. But I think it's a little different with Asians. And the thing is that there is a stigma towards white male and Asian female couples because they perceive the relationship as fetishistic, or they're uncomfortable with the reasons why white men might prefer East Asian women. But I don't see as much of a negative perception towards East Asian male and white female couples. And so I think that within that particular racial mix, I think the sex interaction is flipped. And so you see more socially dominant and aggressive personalities in the white male and Asian female couples than you see in the opposite type, right? But on average, because these are whites dating Asians, I think that the phenotype you're more likely to observe in the white male and East Asian female couples is autism. I don't think you're as likely to see.
I heard somewhere like, well, I've noticed this a bit too, but like people who are HAPA from an Asian dad and a white mom, they tend to be more well-adjusted.
I haven't seen that because I was raised in Spain and you don't see as many HAPAs, but it's possible, yeah, perception. I'm not sure.
They don't maybe struggle as much socially as something I've heard speculation about.
Okay. You grew up in California, right?
Yeah,
I assume
did.
You
knew
many HAPAs. Okay, that makes sense.
And also half white, half Latino people are pretty common in California too.
Right.
Do you think that mass automation and AI will create or accelerate Darwinian selection pressures?
Let me think about that. I guess my guess is probably not. And the reason is that if we have mass automation, people are not going to be working right. And the kinds of traits that cause people to have difficulty working, like low intelligence or low levels of conscientiousness, are not going to be selected against as strongly in social situations or dating. So I think it's going to slightly decrease selection pressure. But I'm not entirely sure, and I don't think that the decrease in selection pressure would be notable. I don't even think you would notice it in real data.
What do you think about the impact of genetic engineering in the future, including gene editing and artificial limbs?
Yeah, I have friends who are doing it. I know people who are running companies who are doing it. I'm definitely very close to like the first mover circle of people who are doing this eugenic stuff. But the problem is that genes matter, but they don't matter that much. Of course, they matter a lot for stuff like height, intelligence, physical appearance, personality to a lesser extent. But for stuff like whether they take drugs, whether they're even happy, whether they make a lot of money, like I think that stuff is less genetic than your psychological phenotype. So there's already a barrier in eugenics.
Do have some criticisms of hereditarianism. You embrace it, but you think some people are too much of a reductionist.
Yes, definitely.
Do you think culture and nurture matters significantly as well?
Culture, I'm not sure, but nurture, yes. Just anecdotally, I should be 3 inches taller than I really am. I have no idea why I'm 5'7", to be honest. It's rather sad. But it's not really a big deal, to be honest. Back when I was 13, I was pretty tall for my age, and I didn't notice a big difference in female attraction. Though it might be different as an adult, I'm not really sure. But independent of that, the thing about eugenics right now is that our GWASs aren't very good right now. And so regardless of how heritable traits are, you just can't explain that much variation in stuff like intelligence, education. We don't even have like a physical appearance GWAS.
Can you just explain that word GWAS? Because I think the audience, people in the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Who don't know.
So a GWAS is a study where you take genes that vary quite a bit within human populations and you associate them with traits. And if you have enough people, you can make like a decent predictor for a trait just based on people's genes. And so using that, you can actually select embryos that are higher in their genetic predisposition to educational attainment, to happiness, to intelligence, almost anything you want. But we don't have GWASs for certain traits like physical appearance, and the personality GWASs are absolutely horrible. It's very, very hard to explain personality traits using genes. I think some of it just has to do with self-reporting. I don't think self-reported personality is very good. But independent of that, I think that eugenics could get good. I think genetic engineering could get good in the future if we use more advanced methods of selecting embryos. So one thing people have proposed is iterated embryo selection. And what that does is that you take a batch of embryos, let's say 10, you select the best embryo of those 10, and then there is some process, there's a bit of a gap of in my knowledge here, but I think there's a process you can use to make an embryo into an egg, and then you and then you make various eggs based on that egg, and then you refertilize those eggs, and then you just keep doing this process, and over time, if you do it enough times, you'll get like a really strongly selected embryo. I don't think people are not doing that right now, but if people do that, they will get like very large gains, because of how the math works.
Do you expect the incel issue to get worse in the future, and what are your thoughts on which traits are being removed from the gene pool by the incel issue, and like why it's growing, and what do you predict will happen with it in the future?
I have a friend who's studying the incel issue. He found that the incel issue is getting worse in the United States, but it's not getting worse in the rest of the world. It's not getting worse in
I
Japan,
think you know what I
not
think
getting
I
worse in
saw a study on
Italy, not
Twitter
getting worse in
too that
Australia.
actually in England, like the rate of sex among adolescents has actually gone up slightly in England, while in
Oh,
the
that's
United
interesting. I
States it's
had no idea.
crashing. But that is
I,
interesting.
huh, okay. The thing about American dating, not to sound like a bitch, but it's horrible. A lot of people are fat. To be frank, most people don't find fat people attractive. Because people have less children now, they don't. Okay, I think this is a nurture effect that does exist. I think if you have a lot of siblings, you learn to cooperate and compromise with others in a way that you don't if you're just
Like
an
only
only
childs
child.
become more
Yeah,
socially
yeah, yeah.
awkward. Yeah, I think another trend is when you have a declining fertility rate, it means that there's less, like with millennials and zoomers, millennials are larger, so you have millennial men who want to date zoomer women who are a smaller demographic
I could
cohort, the
believe that,
demographic
yeah.
issue too.
Yeah, that sounds plausible. The other thing about American dating is that America is a very racially diverse place. People generally want to date people of their own race. And as a result, if you have a more racially mixed society, people are going to have less sex, they're going to have less children, and this is actually borne out empirically too. It's not just something you can kind of rationally deduce with your brain, it's also borne out in the data. Also, like that mental health crisis thing that people are posting about on
Oh,
Twitter?
yeah.
It might be real, but if it's real, it's specific to the United States. You don't see increases in depression among European people. You only see it in American people.
Maybe in the UK to a degree, but I think Europe is less atomized, like it's more homogeneous, and you have things like walkable communities and higher levels of social capital.
Yeah, my experience in Europe was that dating just seemed easier for people.
You mean when you were living in Spain?
I don't mean to brag, but I got a decent amount of female attention in high school. And it seems that that's just not the case in the United States. Even if you try, it's just harder to find girls who like you. I don't know.
You predict these issues, this, the incel issue, you predict it to get a lot worse.
Not sure. There's two ways you could go about this. You could maybe think that America's just a first mover in this regard, and Europe is going to get incels as the same trends take hold. Or maybe America is a unique case, and the incel issue is not going to come about in Europe or Japan. I think it depends on a lot of things. If Europe accepts a lot of immigration from the rest of the world, you might see a rise in incels just because of that. People
You mean
prefer to date
among
their
the
own race.
migrants or among the natives too?
Both. It makes it harder to date for everybody because there's less people of your own racial group within a given area.
Do you really see wokeness in decline as a lot of conservatives are celebrating, or do you expect another huge woke backlash?
I'm not sure about this. The thing is that it's hard to make predictions when you don't have an outside view or another situation to generalize from. But my prediction is that wokeness is declining in the short term because it's accelerated as far as it can go. I don't think you're going to get normal black and Hispanic people to believe in total C-death, if you know what that means. Total white extermination. Like, you can't get normal black and Hispanic people to support killing white people. Like, that's never going to happen. And because of that, there's just a cap on how much craziness you can inject into a society at a given moment. I think we've reached that peak. I think that people started to have second thoughts when people started discussing reparations or trans issues. I think that's when people started to have second thoughts on the whole wokeism thing. Now, I think people are a little too eager to celebrate. The first thing, just about the trans issue in particular, if people tried to make homosexuality acceptable in 10 years in the 1970s, they would fail. You would find the same thing that you find in the modern day with trans people, and that's just you can't change people's opinions that quickly. Older generations have to die. People have to maybe wait 20 years. It's what happened with the gay issue, right?
So you're saying, like, it is wokeness, even though superficially it's declined short term,
yeah,
it is taking hold among a lot of in schools, there's a lot of indoctrination. And that has a huge ripple effect in the future.
The thing is that when a population's belief changes with regard to some kind of political or ideological view, what you typically see is both an age and a cohort effect, where, I mean, I actually said it wrong. You observe both a cohort and year effect. So what that means is that if, let's say, people are getting more accepting of homosexuality, part of it is just because of changes within the same people, and part of it is also because newer cohorts who are more accepting of homosexuality are replacing older cohorts who died, to put it bluntly. And so I think that you just need more time to change people's opinions with regard to issues than 10 years. And, you know, the fact that the left failed to kind of normalize the whole trans thing doesn't make me think that it's not possible based on that. The second thing is that I think that wokeness is going to adapt to the future political climate. And I think that the future political climate, I'm not really sure on this because, you know, I can't see the future, right? But my prediction is that the future political climate is going to be heavily influenced by climate change and increases in immigration.
And what about automation?
I've changed my position on this pretty recently. Before, I was skeptical of the degree to which AIs could replace normal white-collar workers. Now, I think it's easier to do because it's possible to integrate agency and intelligence into the same machine. We saw it with Manus, where it can do all these things like unzip files. It can write code on its own. I mean, GPT could do this, things like these before, but definitely not to the same extent. And so I think it's completely possible that there's more economic growth in the 21st century than the 20th century, for example, just because of AI. But I'm less optimistic about society and culture.
So you have an article on your Substack predicting on future predictions and trends.
Yeah.
And your predictions seem to be, you predict stagnation, either collapse, but you're not optimistic either about the future.
No. So just for a little bit of background, I grew up in a reasonably wealthy family. I've observed a lot of people from different social classes because I was raised Mormon. My perception is that money honestly doesn't matter that much. Like, it's always better to have more money, but it's a little overrated. I don't think people change that much after they get wealthy. What I can say is that, wait a second, I've blinked out a little bit. You asked about, like, the social and cultural predictions I had.
How you predict more stagnation rather than, you're not optimistic, but you don't predict collapse either.
No, I don't predict collapse. I think collapse is very unlikely. The thing about collapse is that people want to, people kind of want it to happen in kind of a weird way, even though collapse is a bad thing.
You think it's more like how they're unhappy with their lives, so they want, it fulfills a psychological need to see society that's really screwed them over personally collapse.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. Empirically, I think that there's, well, not empirically, but kind of reasonably, there's a few things that you could expect to cause a collapse. One of them is just nuclear war. Like, if a few people get a little loony, things could definitely get really ugly.
Like, I mean, it's not the most likely scenario, but, like, right now there's these skirmishes between India and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like nothing ever happens. It's just too...
Oh, yeah, like when Israel and Iran were to go to war, and that ended up being a nothing burger.
Yeah, I don't know. Nothing ever happens, just seems to always win. But I think something ugly could happen. I don't doubt it. But even if India and Pakistan start nuking each other, it's not like they're going to be nuking Russia and America. So I don't think India and Pakistan nuking each other is going to have a very large effect on the rest of the world, as ugly as that sounds. Another thing that I think could cause a collapse is a pandemic. Because it turns out that the modern technological society is just not very good at dealing with pandemics for political and logistic reasons. So I think that a pandemic that could result in a lot of lost years of civilization if it gets ugly enough. Otherwise, I am not, I'm not
COVID,
a collapse believer.
COVID didn't really... It didn't really cause a collapse, as some people anticipated, but
I mean,
it kind of
COVID
exacerbated...
COVID wasn't very dangerous, though.
Yeah, it was dangerous, but it more exacerbated, like, existing negative trends from the 2010s.
Like, when I mean dangerous, like, COVID wasn't as bad as the Black Death.
Right.
Is what I'm trying to say. Like, of course, COVID killed a lot of people, I don't doubt that, but it wouldn't be as bad as the Black Death coming back, or something like that.
What do you think about people saying that Trump's tariffs could cause an economic collapse?
I like Trump. I didn't vote for him. I don't vote based on principle, but I like Trump. I support him. I am not big on his tariffs personally. I don't think the logic behind them makes sense. The thing about tariffs and trade deficits is that if you have a trade deficit, that means that more money is exiting your economy than entering it, but it also means that more stuff is getting into your economy than entering it.
So it's a sign.
And in my
that
opinion, what matters is
countries.
The stuff, not the money. I don't think the U.S. is harmed by its conditions of trade or whatever you want to call them.
Before we wrap up, Sebastian, is mm-hmm. there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics?
I don't think so. I think we can wrap up.
So do you want to plug your Substack or any other social media or projects that you have?
Sure, I am Jensen Jeans. Not jeans in the human sense, but jeans in terms of the apparel that people wear on their legs. And I'm SubJenSub on Substack.
Sebastian Jensen, great show. Thank you so much for being on.
All right. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.